Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we have a conundrum to consider. A book that cannot be read by anyone. So it's kind of a riddle in the dark, isn't it? Like something that Gollum might ask of Bilbo, or Bilbo might cunningly ask of Gollum.
Right. It's like, I walk, but I have no feet. I stand, but I have no legs.
Yeah. So it is an intriguing kind of riddle. Why can't the book in question be read? So we instantly can think to some of like the tricks of riddles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps the book does not exist. You cannot read a non-existent fictional book such as Jorge Luis Borges' The Book of Sand, or Arturo Perez Reverta's The Book of Nine Doors to the Kingdom of Shadows. These are books that exist within stories or within other works that have no reality in our world. Likewise, you cannot read a book that no longer exists, you know, a book that has become lost, such as, you know, the various destroyed Maya codices or Aristotle's Second Book of Poetics, which, of course, is a major plot point in Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose.
Right.
But no, the book that we're talking about here, it is real, and it definitely exists.
Okay.
So that might lead you to the next level of contemplation here. Okay, well, perhaps this book cannot be read because it is forbidden. You know, some powerful librarian or clerk keeps it hidden, perhaps alongside the Ark of the Covenant or something, right?
Okay, so like that same Aristotle text, but in the name of the rose.
Right, yeah, where somebody just preventing you from viewing it and reading it. No, that's not the case with this book, because plenty of people have attempted to read it and still attempt to. Any serious scholar can, they can actually travel to its physical location and go through the necessary, paperwork, one presumes, can examine it physically. And you, the listener, can even attempt to read it on the internet, or you can acquire a printed facsimile, many of which are very nice, I understand.
Okay, I got one. Well, there are a lot of texts from the ancient world that only exist in some incredibly degraded format, right? So we have evidence that a book existed, but you can't make out what's on the page anymore. Maybe there's only a scrap of it left.
Right. It's been destroyed, or perhaps it's been scraped away and other things have been printed on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's not the case with this book. It's actually quite well preserved for a centuries-old manuscript.
Okay, here's one. Maybe you can't read it because it's not made of language.
Ah, now that's a clever guess.
Yeah, a picture book or something.
Yeah, but this book actually contains quite a bit of text.
Okay.
And so that leads us to the next level of contemplation here. Okay, then the text must be in a language that is forgotten, or a nonsensical representation of language, or perhaps what appears to be language is actually a code for something else.
Okay, so there is a book, you can look at it, there is text in it, but for some reason you can't make sense of the text.
Right. And in this, we are getting to like the heart of many of the discussions surrounding the book we're going to be discussing today. This book is written in a language or code or some other manner of textual form that no one, at least no one living or no one that has lived in the previous centuries, is capable of understanding. In fact, while various people have claimed to have cracked it or translated it or figured out some or all of its secrets, we can state with a fair amount of certainty, as of this recording, and probably for the shelf life of this episode, no one has been able to read this book, at least not for many, many centuries.
At least as far as we know, unless one of these people on like YouTube or Reddit is onto something and nobody's really, nobody's given them credit yet.
Yeah, or somebody's figured it out but decided not to share it with anyone, which is generally not the case. Generally, there are plenty of people even today that are claiming to have some theory as to, they have some angle, some end that's going to allow them to crack this nut.
So what we're talking about today is a real manuscript that exists in the world. Some of you may well have heard of it. It's actually, I think if you go back, it's something that listeners have requested us to cover in the past. I don't know if we've got a request recently, but in the years I've been on the show, I know people have written to us asking, like, hey, what's your take on it? And it is a manuscript known as the Voynich manuscript, or I've also heard it pronounced Voynich, but I think we'll say Voynich.
Yeah, I think
it's
V-O-Y-N-I-C-H. All right, well, let's just describe it to everyone. For starters, we should just drive home that, again, you can look up a copy of this. It's readily available on archive.org,
I believe.
Yes,
exactly. And not only you should. We'll talk more about the contents of it in a minute. But maybe we should start with just the base physical reality of what this codex is. It's in the form of a codex, right? So it's not a scroll. It's like a folding book with pages that you can leaf through.
Yeah, it's roughly 7 by 10 inches.
Uh-huh. Not a huge tome,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, not huge.
So a lot of these older books you think of as being this big thing that you put up on a lectern and you open the giant cover of it that may be made of wood or whatever, mm-hmm. and you leaf through the huge pages with their illuminations. But no, this is a little thing, maybe to be cradled in a wizard's knobby fingers. the precise dimensions I was reading are, it's like 23.5 centimeters by 16.2 centimeters and about 5 centimeters thick. So it's little.
Yeah, and that's what's the page count? Somewhere in the neighborhood of 240 to 270?
So the number of pages existing today, I've seen a couple of different counts of 240 or 246 pages. I think that might be depending on what types of leaves you're counting on the edges. But it's believed that some original pages of this manuscript are lost. It may originally have had around 270 pages or so, but we don't know for sure. And these pages are made of parchment, specifically of vellum, which was a common medieval writing material. Parchment means a prepared version of an animal skin that was used for writing. Vellum specifically, I think, is calfskin. So these are calfskin pages with ink writing on them. Also about the pages in this book, we should note that in the format we have it today, some pages appear to be out of order. So I think at some point this manuscript was not fully bound. It's bound now, but I think it has been through different binding over the ages. And at some point, it looks like some pages got shuffled out of order. And the version we have it now has pages that look like they're from the wrong section in which they're currently placed. So that's just how it is as we have it. It's probably due to some owner throughout the centuries making an error and rearranging them when the pages became loose.
The text in the book is closely written in free-running alphabetic script. The number of letters, one source I was looking at said 19 to 28 letters. I don't know if you found a different figure.
Yeah, I've seen several different estimates of like 15 to 25 or estimates of 30 letters. I think it's difficult because there are some symbols in there which could be copies of the same letter you've already seen or could be slightly different letters. And it's hard to tell if you're not working with a known alphabet.
Right. And that's part of it is that like these, for the most part, don't seem to have real counterparts in European letter systems.
Right.
You know, at first glance, it looks like just standard text that should relate to some European language. But upon closer inspection, things become more difficult.
The letters have a lot of fascinating loops in them.
Yeah.
Like they're full of these knots and lassos.
And then the illustrations, of course, which I've already alluded to, it has all these strange line drawings that have been colored in with watercolors. Mm-hmm. And they consist of, you know, plants, possible astrological drawings, weird illustrations of naked women seeming to bathe or shower in what might be giant plants.
Or other things. We'll get more into what the illustrations represent later on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was it's written in ink. I think it has watercolors in it.
Yeah, the watercolors, yeah. Definitely to color the illustrations. But then the ink itself, I read, is a brown ink, and it seems to have been like an inexpensive ink of the time, so nothing particularly notable.
Okay. Now, we've already mentioned that it is not a readable document. It is in a language. If it is a language, the language is unknown.
Yeah, sometimes called Voynichese.
Which is just a modern appellation because we don't know what it is.
Yeah, and it's something like 170,000 characters in the book. Some, you know, we already talked about the number of alphabetic characters, maybe somewhere in the range of 25 to 30, depending on what you define as being a distinct alphabetic character.
Uh-huh.
And then roughly, 35,000 strings of characters of varying length, which can be interpreted as words.
Yeah, these are usually thought of as words, whether by the, you know, cryptographers who look at this. there are something like 35,000 or like 37,000 words in it. They might not correlate to real words.
Mm-hmm. Now, where will you find this book now? Well, you'll find it in the United States.
Yeah.
We'll get into the history of the book that brought it to the United States, but it is currently housed at the Benecke Rare Book Room at Yale, New Haven, Connecticut.
Yeah, so it's in a library at Yale. And it is open to being looked at by scholars. I remember I read a couple of sources talking about how later in his life, Umberto Eco
yes.
went to view it personally.
Yeah, he was visiting the library. It's the only book in the library that he asked to view. And you can find photos of him, Umberto Eco, reading or, well, looking at the book.
And of course, it's a perfect thing for Umberto Eco to show interest in.
Oh,
if
yeah.
you've read The Name of the Rose, you know his love for mysterious manuscripts of unknown medieval origin. And that gets to one of the real mysteries of this text. This text is one of the great standing mysteries of, of medievalism, of linguistics, of cryptography. It's just this wonderful enigma that's still out there. And part of the enigma is we don't know its actual origin. We pick up with it in history at a certain point
mm-hmm.
where we know where it first arrived and was recorded, but we don't know who made it or why they made it or how they made it.
Right, yeah. For the longest, there was also no carbon dating of the book. So estimates used to range, usually people were saying 15th century or so, some were saying 13th century.
And I think there's a reason for that, because it was originally attributed to the English monk and philosopher Roger Bacon, of course, considered by many to be one of the fathers of modern science. And since Roger Bacon lived in the 13th century, if he had written it, this would place its origin in the 13th century. But I don't think any modern scholars actually believe Roger Bacon wrote it. And later radiocarbon dating would prove that.
Right. And we'll get back to the Roger Bacon connection in a bit. In 2009, the vellum that it's printed on was carbon dated at the University of Arizona, and it was carbon dated to the early 15th century, so 1404 to 1438, roughly.
Uh-huh. And so one note on how carbon dating works, of course, is that carbon dating is used to date things that were at some point alive or at some point had carbon from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere fixed into them
mm-hmm.
because a certain known proportion of this carbon is radioactive. It decays at a known rate. So therefore, you can tell basically if it comes from a thing that was once alive, when did the thing that it was made out of die, right? When did it stop incorporating new gas from the atmosphere into itself? So you could say that it could have been no earlier than this time that the document was produced, but it could possibly have been later that the document was produced, just as long as the vellum was actually this old.
Yeah, it kind of depends on how long the vellum was sitting on the shelf, right?
Yeah.
Also, it's bound in goat skin, though it also seems to have once had a wooden cover based on some of the details in the manuscript.
Yeah, I think it's had different binding
yeah.
over the centuries. Now, there used to be some theories that this was a modern forgery, maybe by the very book collector it's now named after, who we'll discuss later on. But that really seems unlikely now, given that it has been carbon dated to the 15th century, right?
Yeah. Now, in terms of the author, that's part of the unknown origins here.
Nobody signed it.
Yeah. Handwriting analysis has suggested as few as two or as many as eight writers, which, of course, wouldn't really be that uncommon for a book of this time period.
Okay, but at least the illustrations are signed, right?
No. Nobody knows who made the illustrations. The origin is ultimately unknown. And when it comes to, copies, this is it. This is the one copy of the Voynich manuscript.
Now, we mentioned, of course, that Voynich, that what we call it now is the Voynich manuscript, and that name comes from a modern person, not from, a medieval person. So what this book was originally called was?
Well, we don't know.
Yeah, unknown.
Yeah, I mean, it's had various sort of catalog numbers along the way, but, as we'll come back to, Voynich refers to Wilfred Michael Voynich, and dates back to 1912. So given the history of the book, its current name is relatively recent.
I think maybe we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we can discuss more of the mystery of this fascinating text.
All right, we're back.
So we're talking today about the Voynich manuscript, the classic enigmatic text believed now to be from the 15th century or so due to carbon dating. But we don't know who wrote it. We don't know where it came from. We just know it sort of shows up at one point in history and then trades hands for a while until it resurfaced around 1912. Now, if you have never browsed through this book, do yourself a favor and just pause the episode and go do that now. A scan of it is, of course, you know, obviously not if you're driving or whatever, but...
Then just get the audiobook.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? An audiobook version of the one. Yeah, amazing. We got to cash in on that. But so you can look it up on the internet. There's a full scan of it that's hosted on archive.org. You can flip all the way through the book. I would say it is almost a necessary experience, just the same way that if you have the means, you should try to travel and like expand your mind through seeing other cultures. If you have the internet, you should try to expand your mind through this esoteric document.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, this stuff like this is the reason we have the internet. That's one of the benefits of the internet is being able to, you know, a document like this can be accessed by everybody.
Yeah. Now, there are a few things we can't, if we're going to be chasing the mystery of who created this document, can it be translated, what does it mean, we should look at a few other facts about the text itself. So it's in a script that is clearly written from left to right and from top to bottom. So much like English or like many other European languages, but not all languages are like this. Arabic is not like this. Urdu, Farsi. I mean, there are a bunch of examples of languages that go from the right to the left. So it is probably not drawing from that kind of tradition unless they just switched it for no reason. No, another fact that might seem interesting to us about the text is that there are no punctuation marks. But it turns out that's not necessarily all that interesting given the time from which it comes, because it's extremely common in older documents in many languages for there not to be punctuation. Another thing is that there are no chapter markings or subheadings, but based on the illustrations, it's clear that there are sections that appear to be about different subjects, if they're about anything. And I think maybe we should talk about some of those different sections of the manuscript to try to help us understand it.
Absolutely. Well, the first half of the book is the herbal section, and it's full of botanical illustrations.
You could say that. Yeah, I mean, they clearly are supposed to be plants, but we should stress that while some of the illustrations of plants look kind of like plants you would recognize, I'm not necessarily saying they are illustrations of real plants, but they at least look like terrestrial plants. Some of these illustrations do not look like terrestrial plants. Some look like green ice snakes from the methane lakes of Titan, or like strange constrictor caterpillars from the heart of a comet. They, truly weird alien drawings, things that are sort of green and look like they have leaves, but also have what look like tentacles or eyeballs.
Yeah, they are strange to behold. And this is the most normal section of the manuscript.
Yeah, it is. So the German computer scientist Klaus Schmeh, who wrote a 2011 article for Skeptical Inquirer about the Voynich manuscript. I'm going to refer back to that article quite a few times. But he was writing about this section, and he writes that none of the illustrations of plants in the document have been conclusively identified by botanists. So nobody's been able to look at that and say, yep, that is definitely a geranium. One theory by the botanist Hugh O'Neill claimed to have identified two of the illustrations as the sunflower and the capsicum plant. And of course, capsicum is a genus of plants in the nightshade family that produce peppers.
Hmm.
Peppers are great, right? Except peppers are not European.
Hmm.
So both of these plants did not spread to Europe until after contact with the Americas, which would date the document a little bit later. But there is not a general consensus that O'Neill's identification of these illustrations is correct. It's just not clear at all that these are actually drawings of sunflowers and pepper plants. So generally, the botanical section is big old question marks. Some of them look like they could be real plants, but there's none you can point to. There are none you can point to and say, yep, we know what that is.
Well, this trend kind of continues in the next section, which is the astrological section, which is full of circular illustrations that are often interpreted as being perhaps astrological in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But as pointed out by Josephine Livingston in her New Yorker article, The Unsolvable Mysteries of the Voynich Manuscript, which I'll also refer back to. She says that to call this section astrological is generous.
Yes, because it doesn't – now, there are illustrations in it that do seem to correlate to classic astrological imagery. But then again, there are depictions of like astronomical objects that don't appear to correlate to anything. For about 8 or 9 years now, I should just say, I've had a page of the Voynich manuscript pinned up on the backboard of my desk at work. I don't see it as much now because now it's under the raised part of my desk. Mm-hmm. But it's a page from what is believed to be the astrological section. Specifically, it's a page that just has a bunch of concentric circles of these untranslatable words between magus-looking dudes sitting in buckets or dunk tanks or something with stars coming out of their fingertips, and they're all ringed as if in reverence around the figure of a prancing goat with a mouthful of green plant matter. And I figured that's a good enough metaphor as anything for the work we do.
All right. The next section is often referred to as the balneological section.
Right. And of course, that refers to the study or field of bathing, which if that sounds like, wait a minute, could there be a field of that? Yeah, in medieval texts, there were a lot of thoughts about bathing. There were thoughts about the restorative powers of certain types of waters, mm-hmm. or mineral baths, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an important subject. You're getting into the issues of hygiene, which, of course, influence overall bodily health, public health, but also hygiene has long been intertwined with our ideas of spiritual purity as well.
Now, you might think, okay, well, this section's got to be kind of normal because it's just depicting people bathing, right? Bathing can't get that weird. This is maybe the weirdest section of all.
Yeah, because there are all these images of nude female figures in pools of liquid, I mean, or tubs of liquid, but also possibly like large oversized flowers. Mm-hmm. And then there's tubular plumbing that suggests plants or even like viscera of some sort, you know?
Yeah, it's a very strange section of the manuscript. So the writing in this part, I noticed, suddenly gets very dense, whereas in previous pages, there might have been a large illustration of the plant and then some small, you know, some lines of text around it. Here you've got some densely packed text. And again, I want to stress that some of the illustrations of this section look like they could be referring to real-world objects and practices. Like, some appear to just show nude women bathing, maybe in mineral baths or in streams or in aqueducts or along waterfalls. But others show things that I don't even know how to describe. Like, I've got an example here for Robert to look at that is, it's like a woman standing in what looks like a giant instrument horn that's growing out of something. It's this spreading horn that I think maybe is supposed to have water flowing in it. But then also growing out of this horn is like this alligator pod that,
yeah,
I don't know how to, I mean, it's sort of green, gray, brown with like holes that have water coming out of them. But
like a space tentacle with shower heads, like, yeah, bio shower heads coming out of it.
With like ridged alligator scales on, yeah, its back. And yeah, like lotus pods that have water, yeah.
Yeah, like it almost has kind of like a Susian or even like a Giger-esque quality to it.
I was noticing in this section how much the Voynich manuscript, and I think this is not an accident, how much it reminds me of another book that I've liked for years, the Codex Serafininus.
Oh, yes.
Which is an entirely fictional, intentionally fictional encyclopedia created by the Italian artist Luigi Serafini in the late 1970s. I think it was published in 1981. Basically, it is like an artist's attempt to create a new Voynich manuscript type document. It's got a constructed language, lots of alien illustrations of plants, animals, objects, and processes that don't exist on Earth. It's like an encyclopedia from another world. But that is basically what the Voynich manuscript sort of appears to be.
All right, so we've had plants, we've had possible charts of the stars and so forth, we've had weird alien showers. And then at the end here, this final section is what, according to Livingston, seems to be related to practical instructions for the use of the mysterious plants from earlier. It basically looks like it has recipes at the end.
Yeah, and I think this breaks down into multiple sort of subsections. Like, it is believed that there some parts of it are supposed to be pharmaceutical, mm-hmm. Like they depict the creation of medicines and storage in vials, and other parts appear to be about cooking or something.
Yeah, so it's just as mysterious as the rest of it. But at this point, you don't really encounter any illustrations. It's more textual in nature.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so this is the book, and the book is just so unique in its style. It does not seem to have any true surviving peers. It does not cleanly fit with late medieval alchemical texts, because certainly there are other weird texts.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's something we should point out. I mean, if you're thinking, Well, how could a text be about plants and astrology and bathing and hygiene and medicine and cooking all at the same time? That's a weird combination of subjects. I would say, actually, this is not unusual at all for the time it was written. There were plenty of encyclopedia-type documents that collected diverse subject matter at the time, and there was a general blurring of the lines between science, medicine, magic, and household advice.
Right. I mean, if you were the type of individual that either wrote or contributed to the writing of a book, you likely had a lot to say about various topics.
Right. Or a lot to crib from earlier encyclopedias. I mean, a lot of times what you'll find in some of these medieval encyclopedias is a mixture of original observations with people like, I don't know, reproducing encyclopedia entries by Pliny or something, and just saying like, and here's the ancient wisdom of Scipio Africanus.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to a quote from Umberto Eco in The Name of the Rose, the observation that books speak to other books.
Right.
You know, that translations from other books, ideas from other books. But it does not seem that there were a lot of books, at least books that have survived, you know, that were speaking to the Voynich manuscript.
Like, yeah.
It does seem to be this singular thing that's left out, that's, you know, it doesn't really fit in with manuscripts of the period. You know, it's, in many ways, it's kind of like an outside context book, at least to most of those who have viewed it over the last several centuries.
Though,
of course, to be clear, many books of the past were lost. Many languages were lost. Whole cultures have perished. So just because it's one of a kind now does not necessarily mean it was always one of a kind.
Yeah, there could have been a whole library of Voynich-type books that just all got lost except for this one.
And then likewise, the context of our texts are always fading away. I mean, that's why it's always instructive to, if you pick up, say, the works of William Shakespeare, or, you know, you pick up a copy of, you know, Dante's The Divine Comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It generally pays off to have some sort of reference guide, unless you were just schooled, say, in Dante's case, in like, you know, in medieval culture and Italian politics and so forth. Like, you need something to help you make sense of all the references,
right?
You know, the cultural context, any symbols that are trotted out,
or the religious context.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And a similar case can be made for the arts. You know, there are some of the stranger works of art from the past. You know, they look extra strange to us because we generally don't have the same, you know, contextual understanding for the references and for the symbols, you know, symbols and references that would have probably been known to the original intended audience. Like, we are not the intended audience of those works. And then I think, along with most theories regarding the Voynich manuscript, you can say that we are certainly not the intended audience of it today.
Mm-hmm.
Though there's at least one, I don't know, there's at least one theory that maybe supports the idea that the way that we are reacting to the Voynich manuscript is appropriate. But
right.
we'll get back to that.
Right. We are going to go on to try to parse out the different theories that could explain its origin. All right. So I wanted to talk about a few more observations about the Voynich manuscript or the Voynich manuscript from that article I mentioned earlier from 2011 in Skeptical Inquirer by the German computer scientist Klaus Schmäh. I thought it made quite a few good points. And one of the most interesting points it made, I don't know why this stuck out to me so much, but I suspect we'll end up referring back to it. He pointed out that there are no visible corrections in the Voynich manuscript. And this is pretty strange for a document produced by hand. Think about it. Could you write out a document of 35,000 words in ink with no mistakes at all, no cross-throughs or scratch-outs?
No. I mean, yeah, I mean, it would certainly have, you'd have to be something that was just so, you know, wrote for you, that was just so, you know, formed in your mind that you could just do it without any mistakes. Or it would have to be something where mistakes didn't matter, such as if you were just making it all up, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel like this is a significant point, because when you look at handwritten or hand-copied documents from the ancient world, there are tons of emendations. You see word is scratched out or crossed through or fixed. I mean, this is just common at a time when documents were handwritten instead of produced by a printing press or a computer.
Yeah, it took a lot of time to make these. It took a lot of skill, and paper was expensive. Ink was expensive. Ultimately, if you had to cross out a word, you crossed out a word.
Yeah, and humans are imperfect copying machines. Mm-hmm. Now, again, we don't know whether the Voynich manuscript is an original document and it's like the original copy from the author, or it's a copy of another document. I would say this This, to me, very much argues against it being a copy from another document. Just because, I mean, scribes make mistakes. You're going 35,000 words. You're going to make some mistakes and end up having to scratch them out and rewrite the word.
Yeah. So this would seem to argue for the idea that this was, if not one of a kind, like this was at least a singular piece, right?
Yes, or it might go for one of the theories we'll talk about later on, the theory that there is not actually a meaning or message in the text. But then again, there are arguments against that, so we should not get committed to that end point. Another thing that Schmee points out is that people have tried to source the book by looking at the astrological imagery in it, but this hasn't really turned up anything solid either. But a great note he has is that some researchers believe to identify illustrations in the book as Andromeda, or as Andromeda fog, like the galaxy Andromeda, or as the Pleiades. But again, he says that this is just, it's speculation, kind of like the botanical thing, you know, where somebody looks at an illustration and says, I think that could be a capsicum plant, you know, that could be a pepper, but it's not clear enough that other scholars look at it and say, yeah, that's definitely what it is.
And this is touching on a trend that we'll continue to discuss. And I mean this in a completely non-magical, non-speculative way.
Right.
But it does seem to be the case that the longer you stare at the Vonage manuscript, the longer you deal with it, the more likely you are to find connections, the more likely you are to see things.
It certainly encourages the conspiratorial cast of mind or the – well, I don't know. Again, there's a nice way to frame that and a bad way to frame that. Mm-hmm. Like when you want to make connections between things. I mean, on one hand, I feel like that's something I love doing on this show – is making a connection you might not have expected between one idea or one thing and another.
Right, and it's how we solve, that's how we figure out so many ancient works of art or works of literature. Mm-hmm. To go back to the Rosetta Stone, that is how we eventually were able to solve the riddle of Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, this is the exercise of figuring things out, but the Vonage manuscript seems remarkably resistant to such unraveling.
Well, right. I mean, and it seems to encourage a perhaps unhealthy type of obsession also, where, I mean, if you take this principle of making connections too far, of course, where you end up is conspiracy theory world, mm-hmm. right? Like you're just finding crazy coincidences between things, or you even get into numerology. You know, oh, it looks like there are, you know, 17 line breaks on this page and that corresponds to the number of wounds on Christ in this painting or something. You know, that kind of thing where you can find connections if you are determined to find connections no matter how tenuous the link. Anyway, so to get back to a few of these observations that I noted from Schmee's analysis, one is that the clothing and hairstyles worn by the people in the illustrations in the Voynich manuscript seem to date the document to Europe in the period of about 1450 to 1520, but it's hard to be sure. But this is something that is done with other documents sometimes. Like if you look at the illustrations of people, what they're wearing, how they wear their hair, that will tend to correlate to certain styles from certain periods and places in history. Schmee points out that the average word length in the document is about 4 to 5 letters. And this doesn't help us a whole lot because that could be consistent with a number of European languages. It just sort of makes it look like, yes, this is plausibly a language. But there are some other things. Like one is that it has fewer recurring words than would appear to be expected for a natural language. And this sort of argues against the idea of the text being a simple letter substitution. But then again, maybe if it is a real language or if it is something in code, it's not a simple letter substitution. Maybe it's a more complex type of cipher. But ultimately, Schmee concludes that no theory has held up under scrutiny yet, mm-hmm. Which is a great place to be because now we get to discuss them.
Absolutely. So what we're going to do is we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we are going to first take us through the known history of the Vonage manuscript, like where when it first occurs and some of the key points in history that we're you know, relatively sure of.
Okay.
All right, we're back.
All right, so as we've mentioned before, we don't know who created the Vonage manuscript. That is one of the great mysteries. We don't know who wrote it. We don't know if it was the original, if the version we have now is the original copy or if it's a copy of something, we don't know for sure. But at some point in history, this document just shows up. And I guess that's where we should dive in. So we're going to dive in the 16th century.
Right. The year is 1586. And this is when the manuscript first pops up in the court of Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II of Bohemia. Who by most accounts was an eccentric monarch,
yes.
Which is not, it's not hard to be an eccentric monarch. Monarchy tends to invite eccentricity. Uh-huh. And this is an individual who is very interested in the occult, in alchemy, and kept a great library. And I've also read was very fascinated by giants and dwarves as well.
Yeah, he apparently collected little people. That seems like a strange kind of medieval monarch fascination,
yeah.
Or I guess Renaissance monarch here.
Yeah, so in many ways is a weird guy, but he's also sort of the character that you would expect from a medieval monarch.
Right. So this document shows up in his possession.
Right, and we are not sure who sold it to him, but the unknown seller sold it for 600 gold ducats. And
is that ducats or ducats?
Ducats.
I think it's got to be ducats.
Ducats.
I like thinking ducats.
Ducats.
Yeah.
I always think ducats. So 600 gold in any way, to put it more in like Dungeons and Dragons level.
Now, this came with like a certificate of authenticity, right?
Yeah, essentially. It came with a letter stating that it was written by Roger Bacon. Now, Roger Bacon, as we already alluded to, was a Franciscan friar who lived 1219 through 1292, roughly, and he was also said to be a wizard. Of course, this is kind of common with learned individuals and of that time, right? Like later on, there are stories about not only were they learned, but perhaps they had powers as well.
Well, as we've discussed on the show many times, in the medieval period and the Renaissance period, there was a significant amount of blurring between the lines of science and magic.
Right.
People who were genuinely making scientific observations about the world and about natural phenomena also sometimes believed in demonology and just kind of like grouped all this knowledge together.
Yeah, I mean, but at any rate, Bacon was an individual who, in many ways, he was an early advocate of what would become the scientific method.
Yeah, empiricism.
Yeah. On the other hand, he was also interested in codes and secrets and certainly later on became very associated with the occult, became sort of a focus of occult interest.
Now, we've already mentioned that modern scholars do not think that the Voynich manuscript was written by Roger Bacon, and it also seems almost conclusively argued against by the carbon dating of it, which put it in the 15th century.
Right. I mean, about the only thing you could make a case for would be, what if Roger Bacon had written it and this was like a copy of that text?
Right.
But then we'd lost all references to the original text, more leaps of believability there.
Yeah.
But at any rate, yeah, pretty much nobody is saying that Bacon had anything to do with the Voynich manuscript other than him being cited in this letter that accompanied it on sale to the Holy Roman Emperor.
So it'd be like if you showed up with a document and you it's a weird document that nobody can read, and you just said, George Washington wrote this.
Right.
You can easily see how attaching the name of a famous person to something could get you more money for it.
So Rudolf II was, the type of individual who was, very excited to obtain this document.
Right.
He probably put some of his best minds to figuring it out, but nobody was able to crack it.
He was a 16th century Redditor, definitely.
Yeah.
He's on the case.
but nobody was able to figure it out. It eluded experts of the time just as it has always eluded experts. So it ends up being passed on to a botanist by the name of Jacob Horicki, I think. The Latin name would be Jacobus Sinapius. But it was passed on to a botanist essentially because it does contain a number of what seem to be botanical illustrations.
Right.
And then the botanist keeps it for 20 years. During this time, Rudolf himself dies in 1612. And then the book passes on to an unknown person who keeps it for yet another 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And then in the 1620s, the book enters the possession of Athanasius Kircher, who lives 1602 through 1680. And this is another just fascinating character.
Yeah.
A German scholar and polymath who also set out to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics at one point.
Uh-huh.
And his assumptions ended up being, incorrect, but he actually made some correct connections between the Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Coptic languages.
Uh-huh.
He also studied Chinese language as well as various artificial languages.
Hmm.
His letters show that he was quite interested in this particular book prior to obtaining it. But then 5 years after acquiring it, he published A Universal Study of Artificial Languages and apparently makes no mention of the Monich manuscript. So presumably it perplexed him just as it perplexed so many others.
That's interesting. So he's interested in this book. He's interested in artificial languages. That would make it seem like either he did not conclude that this was an artificial language,
mm-hmm.
or that he had to stay silent about it for some reason.
Well, and this is just my take. I wonder—
Roger Bacon's people got to.
I would think that maybe another reason would be if he could not figure it out, like he didn't mention it because who wants to be the expert on artificial languages and say, I couldn't crack this.
Well, right. He could have the Isaac Newton mentality where, you know, Isaac Newton said, like, here's what I've figured out as for the cause of gravity, the underlying cause. Mm-hmm. He just said, I do not feign hypotheses.
you can
kind of respect that.
Yeah. Now, I do think it's something we should come back and discuss artificial languages at some point on the show, because it is fascinating to realize that here's this book on the study of artificial languages. And, of course, this is centuries before we encountered Klingon or Dothraki or any of the – or Esperanto.
Right.
So it would be fun to come back to that.
Well, I've actually thought about the idea of covering artificially invented languages on Invention on our other podcast.
That would be a good one.
So keep an eye out over there.
Invention, the other podcast that we do, you can find it at inventionpod.com. You can subscribe wherever you subscribe to your podcast. It is human techno history, one invention at a time.
All right. So Athanasius Kircher, he's got the Voynich manuscript. And what happens to it then?
Well, he has it for a while, but then he becomes a Jesuit monk and he gives away all of his earthly possessions, which includes his books. And so his library and the Voynich manuscript itself lands in the library of a Jesuit seminary, which I believe is a Collegio Romano, just south of Rome, and it remains there for something like 250 years.
Wow.
Though, according to Livingston, the book, quote, appears to have bounced around Prague for a while. In 1639, a person named Baricius described it as quote, a certain riddle of the Sphinx, a piece of writing in unknown characters, unquote, and guessed that, quote, the whole thing is medical, unquote. The book's historical trail vanishes in 1670 up until the time that Voynich purchased it.
And that's from that New Yorker article.
Yes, that's from the New Yorker piece.
Okay. So then we get up to the 20th century, and this is when it shows up with the guy actually named Voynich. Voynich.
Yet another fascinating, weird individual to enter into the history. And we haven't even covered some of the other weird individuals that factor into its history.
So it ends up in the sort of along with a purchase of other books in the hands of this eccentric book dealer named Wilfred Michael Voynich.
Yeah, who lived 1865 through 1930. And yeah, he publishes the entire library. And it ends up being moved to America. And this, of course, includes the book that would take his name.
Right.
So, yeah, Polish-born. He's an interesting fellow, to say the least. He allegedly knew 20 different languages, was at one point investigated by the FBI for possessing Bacon's cipher, an actual cipher for creating coded messages that was devised by Roger Bacon, just to bring Roger Bacon back into everything.
Uh-huh.
And he even apparently sold a forgery to the British Museum at one point, though perhaps by accident.
Yeah. There are whole story. He was a very well-traveled, adventuring individual. At some point, I think he was sent to a prison in Siberia for his political activities. He somehow escaped to England at some point and became a book collector. In that Josephine Livingston article,
mm-hmm.
she talks about this story that he would delight in showing off his wounds to
yes.
people. And he would like lift his shirt up and he would say, here by sword, here by bullet. So Voynich is a really interesting guy. And at one point in hyping his manuscript, this is also quoted in Josephine Livingston's piece, he was talking to the Times and he said, when the time comes, I will prove to the world that the black magic of the Middle Ages consisted in discoveries far in advance of 20th century science. And I think this speaks to a certain kind of attitude that documents like this inspire, and other historical mysteries, all kinds of things, you know, the Antikythera mechanism or untranslated documents. Anytime you've got this object from history that seems to contain information or learning or indicate information or learning, but is not fully solved at the time people are looking at it, it tends to make people want to go toward these almost conspiracy theory level ideas of like lost knowledge and you know, like ancient aliens kind of territory.
Right.
Why do we have such a tendency in those directions? Like why are our brains wired to go to that conclusion rather than like, oh, here's a strange document in code?
Well, I mean, I guess at one level, you know, we look to the modern age and we tend to regard our current scientific technological understanding of the world as superior to that of the past. You know, by and large. I mean, certainly there are areas where, and we've discussed some of these in the show, where we can point to things in the modern world that are perhaps inferior to ways of dealing with things in the past. You know, generally things that are more cultural or interpersonal. But we tend to think, you know, when it comes to like figuring out how the world works, the, you know, especially the natural world, like today is the day, and never have we had a greater understanding. And yet at the same time, there are things that we do not understand about the world yet, and there are things, particularly details from the past, details from history, that we can never fully understand, you know, that are going to just remain, you know, gaps, essentially gaps in the fossil records of our literary and historical legacy.
I've said this on the show before, but I remain committed to a middle position here between the sort of the condescending modern idea that looks at the past and says, ancient and medieval peoples, they were just stupid. They didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. Versus the one on the other hand that tends toward believing in some lost golden age, you know, ancient lost knowledge that far surpasses our own. I think the reality is that it's not like there's an ancient lost golden age. There wasn't an Atlantis where they had flying cars and stuff like that. It's more like that people in the past were struggling with limitations that we don't face. They didn't have the technology we have, but they were also incredibly smart. They were super clever and came up with amazing workarounds and methods for things using the limited technology they have. This is what I always think about, you know, the classic construction of the pyramids example. It's like, no, it doesn't mean that they had like alien technology. It just means that like these were smart people and they had to figure out how to solve big problems with limited tools.
I think also we sometimes fall into this trap of thinking about the, you know, our modern world's contemplation of the past is kind of a battle between present and past. Like the past is an enemy to be defeated in our attempt to understand it. Mm-hmm. We kind of make an adversary out of it. And I guess part of that is maybe like, you know, maybe this part of it is just found in all cultures where the past is something, an enemy to be overcome. Maybe it's part of the colonial legacy, or maybe it's because of Indiana Jones, you know, with, you know, this idea of somebody like physically combating the past in order to acquire its secrets. And then if something is resistant to this assault, then it must have some sort of secret knowledge. There must be something more than, like the fault cannot be our own. It must be some hidden power of the past.
Mm, that's interesting. All right, well, we got to get back to what happened to the Voynich manuscript.
All right, so it was in Voynich's possession, and then he dies, and it passes to his widow, Ethel.
And he died in 1930?
Yes, 1930. And then it passes from Ethel to a close friend who then sells the book to an antique book dealer by the name of Hans P. Krauss in 1961. So Krauss, he tries to find a buyer for the book but cannot find a suitable buyer.
What? Nobody wanted it? Well, or maybe not for his price.
Yeah, I don't know the details on it. I don't know if he was asking too much or he wanted to sell it to the right type of collector.
Oh, right.
I mean, who knows? But
or not somebody who's going to chop it up and make Voynich manuscript sausage out of it.
I don't know. I mean, he ends up donating it to Yale University in 1969. So without knowing the details of Krauss myself, and perhaps there's better documentation out there, you know, I would presume it was a situation of where he's like, I can't sell it to the type of client, you know, the type of you know, purchaser I want, so I'll sell it to Yale. Or perhaps he reached the point where he realized, like, this book is a truly fascinating historical specimen. It does not belong in the hands of a rare occult book. It doesn't need to be in another a rare book dealer's antique stash. It needs to be with a university.
All right. Well, I guess that sort of brings us up to the modern period in which there's been an enormous amount of scholarship on the Voynich manuscript of people trying to both to translate it or decrypt it, which in some ways are similar jobs. Or people trying to figure out what it means or where it came from, who wrote it. a lot of these mysteries remain, and there have been hugely interesting attempts to solve these questions over the decades.
But on that note, we're actually going to have to call this episode and return in a second episode where we'll get into these various attempts to unravel the manuscript. In the meantime, you can check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind at stufftoblowyourmind.com. You can also, of course, find this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Well, wherever you do find us, make sure that you rate and review us. That really helps us out. And, you know, if you want to discuss this episode with other users, other listeners, there's actually a Facebook discussion group called the Discussion Module, Stuff to Blow Your Mind Discussion Module. That's kind of a fun place to check out.
Hey, have you subscribed to our other podcast, Invention, yet? If not, go subscribe to Invention. Subscribe to Invention. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Maya Cole and Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you.